You mentioned Titanic and Avatar, and since you brought those up, among the other titles you brought up, we just kind of pivot to that for a moment. You know, we all have learned and continue to learn, even though he's no longer with us, so many things from composer James Horner. And, you know, interestingly enough, Titanic, which was, you know, kind of one of the first ones when you were there, that was the first one where I actually ever had a chance to meet him. And, you know, back, I think it was 96. And he was recording the sinking cue that day. And to kind of pivot all the way, literally to the very end of his amazing life, was conducting Titanic Live to Picture in Europe on tour when he had that tragic plane crash in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
So what a giant, what a beautiful man. Those two pictures not only are incredibly iconic as films and as creative outputs, but let's just talk a little bit about what James Horner's contribution, in your eyes, through your context and lens, meant to those two bookends, which in your life sounds like were very important bookends. That was the beginning, as you said, in the end of your time at a very wonderful time at Fox, it sounds like.
Sure. I mean, you know, James is was a really special guy and just a really phenomenal and unique talent. And when you're in the room, and you have there's a filmmaker like James Cameron and a composer like James Horner, you know, there's sort of like, what do they need from me? What could I possibly contribute to this dynamic, right? These guys are not sitting here going like, we don't know how to make a movie or we don't know how to make a score. But, you know, Titanic was a really difficult movie just because, you know, it's easy to forget this many years later and after the fact. And of course it was a big hit, but when it was being made, it was expensive. It was over budget. It was a collaboration of sorts between competing studios, and, you know, Paramount had a capped contribution to the budget, and Fox was, you know, sort of potentially hemorrhaging money, and people were worried that it was literally could be such a disaster that it could sink the studio, you know, and Fox had been there before, you know, I mean, Cleopatra almost put Fox out of business. And that's why Century City exists, is because one of the ways that 20th Century Fox stayed afloat was to sell off a big chunk of land, which was the backlot, which is now Century City after being part of 20th Century Fox. But I'm sure people were not talking about that at the time. It's just, you know, kind of an ironic kind of history repeating itself kind of thing potentially. And so, you know, I just remember coming into a very difficult dynamic on Titanic because, you know, music is, you know, sort of at the end of the line of the things that have to happen. And so typically, you know, when you know, there's no extra money lying around at the end of the process. And on any given movie, you know, if there's even some kind of production savings because they came in under budget after they shot the movie, you know, the money might go to visual effects, or it might go to post-production, or it might go to doing previews, or it might go to this thing or that thing. And once you get through all of the, you know, considerations on the long list of where the extra money, if there is any, could go, you know, music's at the very bottom of that list. So never really likely that music's really going to benefit in those situations. Yeah. And Titanic was an extreme example of just, you know, it was a very aggressive, very ambitious plan for a movie that obviously it's a long movie. It's wall to wall music. And James Horner is a pencil and paper. He's not like and even then, you know, synths and samplers were not what they are today, but that was just never the palette that he painted with. He was a, you know, an orchestral composer. Right. And also back then in the more analog era, the process of recording music for film took a lot longer than it does now. Just because mockups weren't as sophisticated and, you know, digital, you know, something you'd hit rewind on an analog tape deck and you'd have to wait for the tape to go back, as opposed to everything now just being nonlinear and instantaneous. And so it's easy to forget that those things, you know, were just made the routine in the studio different. So what you could get in, you know, in 6 hours of recording at Taddeo Studios versus what you can do now that a studio, Taddeo, no longer exists. But so I remember stepping into a dynamic on Titanic where money was tight and tempers were high and the stakes were high and the mood was challenging, and it would put a lot of extra undue pressure, financial pressure and political pressure on James Horner to deliver. And you know, some composers are better than others at handling that, but James is really an artist and was not really, didn't want to have to be in the room for the tense business stuff. And so, you know, a lot of the support that someone like myself could provide, and at the time, Matt Walker was at Fox. And I just remember Matt Walker and I going to meetings where we would just kind of sit around and say, you know, that we only have this much money and there's this much work that has to be done. And what, in what ways can we be kind of smart and innovative and efficient, so that we can equip James to do what he wants to do and get the movie done and not get our heads handed to us for coming back, you know, significantly over budget. And, and all, sometimes that's part of the whole kind of bundle of concerns and considerations, at the intersection of art and commerce. You know, the commerce part is not insignificant. So, I just remember a lot of that on Titanic. It was like equipping James to do the work despite a really tough, mood and political climate. And then, you know, other stories about like the song, the infamous song. And then there was, you know, James wanted to score a trailer. So there was a lot of maneuvering to, you know, record music for the trailer and then have that music be what marketing used in the trailer. That was its own thing. The movie score was just this kind of routine that just kept going and going and going to get all the music written and recorded for the picture. And James Cameron was cutting the movie out at his place in Malibu and didn't have the time to commute back and forth to the studio. So now this kind of technology exists, but it didn't then. So, you know, they literally dug up the parking lot at Tadeo to lay fiber optic lines so that they could have a dedicated two-way video conference capability. So there was a special room at Tadeo where James would record a cue, James Horner would record a cue, and James Cameron could listen to the things and playbacks from Tadeo, and James Horner would go into this little room privately while the orchestra was on the clock, while the meter was running, and have a conversation with James Cameron. And James Horner would go in, close the door. It would just be him. He'd be the only, Cameron wouldn't, I don't think, come on to the monitor. He wouldn't sit in the chair that put him on the monitor until Horner came into the room, closed the door, was the only one there. They'd have a conversation and James Horner would come out and say, all right, here's what we have to do. We have to make these adjustments or those changes. And so all of it was just just being able to facilitate the process was a lot different than the using the tools we have at our disposal to make those kinds of collaborations easier today. So the trailer, getting all the work done for the film, and the song, and James Horner kind of not being able to convince anyone in theory that the tune from the film would yield a good song and that it could be a big, you know, moment at the end of the film. And so he had to kind of go off and conspire in secret, get, you know, Celine Dion to record it as a demo and then come back and cut it in and present it. And obviously the rest is history, but it was just, it was a whole thing at the time. And just, I think there was a bond that comes out of being in the trenches together. Even if I'm the guy in the room, I wasn't waving a baton. I wasn't doing anything, you know, I wasn't transcribing music or helping with orchestrations, or there were all of those experts and technicians and creatives were all already in place. There wasn't, I wasn't there to contribute to any of that. And you certainly didn't need another person in the room with ears or an opinion. So that wasn't my role at the time, but just trying to help, you know, kind of oil the gears, make the process go as smoothly as possible and take the financial and political pressure off of James so that he could do what he was there to do. Right. I think that that created a bond, right? And so there's something really special about being kind of, you know, survivors of those tough, intense experiences together, so that years and years later, I mean, James and I had kept in touch and we'd worked together on one or two things in between. But then when Titanic, you know, comes along, you fire up the, you know, the troops of the band, and there's a little bit of more of a camaraderie because, you know, we've been here before. There's a, you know, kind of more inherent trust unspoken kind of companionship and kind of like, all right, we're going to roll up our sleeves and we're going to do this again. Yeah. And we're going to make it as good as, or if not, you know, better than the last one. So, yeah. You know, it was just, it was a really cool, it was a real, there's a, yeah, it was just a really cool, thing to be in the room while with James and his team, Bill Henriksen and Simon Franklin and,
yeah.
And just the whole team, that, you know, he had used loyally for years.
Yeah, yeah.
Just that was one of those, that was one of those teams that was just really special to, to be around and to be an honorary part of.
Yeah. A composer's composer and a director's director, you know, you have those two things in the same room. It's, you know, I mean, movie music, in general, you know, I've always kind of felt like when it works, you know, and it's just all music and film, you know, whether or not it's the grand orchestral stuff in the style of a James Horner or Bruce Broughton or a John Williams, or it's a synced song, or it's a song that was originally written, which we'll get into, I hope, in a little bit here, talk a little bit about, you know, syncing and licensing and things like that, which I know is a big part of what you do. When it works, it's magical. And oftentimes you can't describe why it's magical. And I think that's one of the great things about film music. And one of the reasons, if not the primary reason, why I fell in love with it when I was a young boy. You know, it's just this element of true magic that you can go back and access, you know, through your brain or through your heart or whatever, and all these many years later. What a great set of kind of temples to bookend your time there at Fox. And one of the last things you said there, one of them was this trust. You mentioned trust, and what a massive topic that is, which, you know, we could spend another hour and a half talking about just that and the importance of it in the process. But I appreciate you mentioning that very much, because without it, so much can break down. And on a film like a Titanic or an Avatar, where you've got so much on the line, at the least of which are the many $1 bills that keep stacking up, trust is an incredibly important part in order to get you to that next part of the risk mitigation process.
Mm-hmm.
So now you're at Universal and you're here and you've kind of moved up the ladder, so to speak, and now you have this even new massive set of responsibilities. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe there's what, around give or take 25-ish or 30 folks in your department that kind of
About 30.
Okay. So there's a lot that goes into what you do. So I'd love to kind of spend some time talking a little bit about that. You know, what's your actual nut and bolt day on average? I know that's kind of a, you know, an open-ended question because it does change from day to day. So why don't we start kind of with a really big year that not only you had, but also the studio. And that's one of the biggest years, you know, 2015. I mean, it was an incredible year for you guys. And not the least of which was one of the results of that incredible year, which was for you a Grammy nomination for 50 Shades of Grey. But in that same year, you had, I mean, the Fast Seven anthem. You had the Pitch Perfect sequel, which was not... you know, a small thing, because the prior film was so massive that you had a lot of expectation. You guys were on the Billboard charts for a long time that year with a lot of the things that you did, and much of that I know you were responsible for. So let's start with 2015. I know that was 15 years into your time there, or sorry, 5 years into your time there. But
sure.
2015.
It was actually, it was the result of being, you know, works that started probably only a year or two into my time there, you know.
Yeah.
So it was sort of, I had taken a new gig, was building a new team. I was fortunate in that, you know, I was given a real opportunity to be kind of entrepreneurial and take a blue sky approach to, you know, sort of having a music department with a bespoke mission statement and kind of like, you know, sort of, you know, Donna Langley put me there and basically said, you know, sort of do what you think is right for the company by, you know, and put together the right department and run it the, you know, the way that makes sense for, you know, this evolving company. And, you know, one of the great things is being on that team where, I think kind of the identity and the culture of Universal is this amazing, portfolio. This is a very diverse portfolio of all different kinds of movies of all shapes and sizes. Right. And so, the year that you're talking about is the year that we had releases like, you know, Bridesmaids, I think Despicable Me was on that list that year, right?
Hator,
50 Shades, Pitch Perfect, and Fast and Furious. And so, you know, releasing all those movies in that year was the culmination of a lot of teamwork and everything that went into the years leading up to 2015. But I think it was just a combination of a lot of factors lining up in such a wonderful way, and the ability to kind of swing for the fences. And, you know, and there are certain movies where it's like, you know, 50 Shades, we knew going in that the soundtrack was going to be a really critically important part of that movie. You know, the books kind of had their own soundtrack, and the specific songs called out in the books were, you know, were not just going to carry over to the film, but, you know, that kind of structure, that identity of, you know, a story that would have a very kind of particular soundtrack to it, we knew was going to be important going in. So, you know, to put the right team together and to take the right approach to really kind of aim as high as possible, and if anything, try to over deliver, and then end up with, you know, the Earned It by The Weeknd and Love Me Like You Do, you know, by Max Martin and Savon Kotecha and Ilya Salmanzadeh, and, you know, performed by Ellie Goulding. Like, there were just some of those things in hindsight came together kind of sort of magically in hindsight. Mm-hmm. It's never easy at the time. There's always a lot of opinions about music. It's never, things aren't ever really done. You know, the committee that makes these decisions is never especially unanimous about, every one of those decisions that gets made. But, you know, 50 Shades came together in a really special way, as did, you know, the anthem for the tragic loss of Paul Walker, which, you know, was a very challenging and difficult thing at the time, because it was, you know, very much Fast and Furious itself. And then also within Universal, that was a real family. It is a real family. And so the loss of Paul was a human thing. It wasn't a business thing. And, you know, then to, you know, when the production, when some critical high level decisions were made about what's going to happen with the movie and how we're going to finish it and everything, you know, to say that we really, you know, there was a song moment at the end of the film, which was really, you know, a saying goodbye moment. And there was both kind of the character narrative, which was not about, it wasn't the death of the character. It was, there were other reasons why in the story we're saying goodbye to that character. But knowing, everybody seeing the movie knows that really what's happening is, you know, we've lost a family member. And so, you know, just the stakes, recognizing how high the stakes are for something as simple as we have to come up with a song that, you know, pays tribute to that, and does it in the right way, that isn't tone deaf or insensitive. It's not you know, a corporate confection, opportunistic kind of, you know, we're going to sell records because we're, you know, so just knowing that it couldn't come off like that really kind of made the parameters and the guide rails very obvious about, you know, what it couldn't be, but put us in a very narrow lane of what it had to be. And so, you know, you go out to, you know, the right songwriters, the right producers, the right artists, and every one of those things from every one of those movies in that, you know, 2015 year that, that was so special for Universal, there, you know, there's, you could pick any one of them, the particular songs that I mentioned, even just those three, or Happy from Despicable Me 2. And we could just spend hours talking about how that one song came to be and all the twists and turns that the journey took along the way to get there. So it's, you know, it's just a good reminder that you can never just look back and be like, oh yeah, we're all just great at what we do. And we just, we made a hit song and then we made another hit song. And, you know, every one of them just really required a lot of effort to get in the trenches, roll up your sleeves, and then really, you know, just not settle, not look, not take the path of least resistance, but actually, you know, deliberately choose the most resistant path. But you know, it's a high risk, high reward kind of high stakes thing on a moment to moment, decision to decision basis. And that's, you know, sometimes when you get the best results. You know, I've never felt from my post as someone who sort of like, you know, sometimes functions as like a team captain to just, you know, to get the right people in the room and to equip them to do their best work and to set them up for success. You know, I'm not entitled to this gig. I have to, You know, people talk about paying your dues and working your way up. Like, I'm still paying my dues. You never, you never get to stop paying your dues. That's what earns you your place in the job that you have, is you're constantly earning it. You know, I think as soon as you start feeling entitled, you know, like that's it, you're done for. So, I really, you know, there was just every one of those collaborations, there was just something really unique and special, about doing the work, getting it made, supporting the picture that's on the screen, and making sure that the right boxes are checked in the right priority order, the right sequence. And then so things like saying we were on the charts and we had a hit and all of that, that's great. That's when it genuinely becomes like, that stuff's gravy. It's great to have a hit. You know, nobody ever sets out to make a bad movie. We could be a $5 million movie or a $250 million movie. Everyone gets around the table and says, we're going to do something amazing and artistic and special and unique. And, you know, and that applies to every department working on the film, and music especially. And, you know, sometimes it works out. Sometimes a bunch of them work out at the same time. If a movie turns out to not be as good as you intended it to be or wanted it to be, it's not because people didn't try or people didn't intend for that movie to be great. It's just sometimes, you know, things don't go from script to screen or speakers as intended. And that's okay too. And I think the big win is in, like I said, a diverse portfolio of all different kinds of movies. And so I'm happy to talk about any one of those in particular, but that's just sort of more of a 30,000 foot view of all of that.
So you spent a good amount of time there talking about songs, you know, originally written songs. Some, you know, some are synced, you license for use in film. Let's talk about that just for a minute. You know, in your eyes, in your role. So I guess it's like a two part question. You know, you're in the role that you're in, but you're also the person that you are. So I'm just kind of curious how you view the use of song versus the use of, say, music score in a film, and what that can do for a picture to heighten it. What are the kind of intricacies from your perspective that go into how you get there? But that is a really interesting kind of collision of creative spirit, because while they're very similar, they're also very different in how they function.
I mean, that's a broad and loaded question. Music in general is a powerful tool in movies. And if you ever need to prove it to someone, just show them a movie without its music, and they'll understand that, you know, the music is to be appreciated. Whether it could be a really, you know, sort of light touch, you know, sort of hint of a score.
Promise?
Yes.
You promise?
Or something really kind of present and bombastic that might be more in between the screen and the audience. So, you know, different material commands, different approaches musically. And sometimes it's really obvious, like, we're going to score this. And sometimes they're, you know, different filmmakers may have different visions of how to use music, or sometimes things fall a little bit more in kind of a standard lane of like, look at what's on the screen. That's clearly going to be scored. Somebody might say, look at what's on the screen. That seems like we're going to score it, but we're actually going to approach this in a more of a kind of song oriented way. And then even when you talk about songs, there, are we going to use existing songs, or are we going to use something new and original, or something in between? Are we going to flip an existing song and do kind of a cool and innovative cover of a song? And so what's cool about music is, like, everything's on the table. There's no right or wrong. Sometimes, you know, the wrong music against picture could be very obvious versus the right music against that same picture could just be undeniably right. You know, it's sort of, it's hard to talk about in words, but you know from trial and error that when something works, you could be auditioning different songs for a different scene in a movie, and you maybe can't put your finger on this one doesn't work and that one doesn't work, but then there's a song there that you don't have to necessarily explain why, but if it works, could be a lyric, could be a vibe, could be a tempo, could be an instrumentation, could be production, could be a chord progression. You know, it's hard to talk about, but there's definitely a lot of trial and error. And then, you know, even just the threshold fundamental stuff like you're asking about is like, should this be an original song? Should this be a cover? People's brains work differently when they're consuming media, you know, giving them, using an existing song or something that people know is a much, it's like a drug delivery of like, it's a much shorter path to lighting up the exhilaration center of somebody's brain for them to be taking in a scene and a story, and their brain is processing all this information as it's coming in. And then you give them a song that they know that was maybe a big hit either at the time, or it was recently, or it was a long time ago, but it's undeniably a song that people know. In a fraction of a second, they're going to go, I love this. I don't even have to think about it. I know from the first second and a half of that song introduction what song that was going to be, and I love it, and it's going to make me enjoy this picture even more. That same sequence, you could put a new original song in there that could be the most perfect song ever written, and it could be worked beautifully to picture, but it's going to impact an audience member differently because they're going to have to learn it as the information comes in. It doesn't make it worse. It just makes it different. And maybe that is the experience you want them to have. And then there's other kind of like asterisks to what I'm saying, where it's like, well, if you're talking about a pop song and you're making something for a soundtrack, you could have that song be a hit before the movie opens. That when they hear it in the movie, they go, oh, this is that song I've been hearing on the radio. That's a big challenge and insanely impossible to do these days. Excuse me. That was one of the things that worked out nicely with 50 Shades, where, you know, we had a pop song and kind of an urban pop song with Ellie Goulding and The Weeknd, and the movie came out Valentine's Day, and we managed to hit the ground running at the top of January of that year and have both songs impact at radio, work their way up the charts really fast and be present in the world. So that when you heard Earned It and when you heard Love Me Like You Do in 50 Shades, even though it all happened in a very compressed period of time, you're watching the movie going like, oh, I love this. Is that Weeknd song that I've been hearing on the radio, and I love it. And now I'm in the movie and I'm in the story and I understand why it's here and what it's commenting on. And it just means that much more to me. Like, that's a different kind of exhilaration than an existing song or a cover song or something that they just hadn't heard before.
Right.
Despicable Me 2 is kind of a different example where Pharrell did all these amazing songs for the first Despicable Me movie and the second Despicable Me movie. And Happy was written for a sequence in the film where Gru, the main character voiced by Steve Carell, who's like the supervillain protagonist of the movie, there's just a sequence where he's being uncharacteristically happy because he's got a crush on Kristen Wiig's character. So he wakes up and there are these girls in his house that have been annoying him that he's kind of taken in. And, but he's so uncharacteristically happy. That's just, it's a sequence, a montage sequence where he makes them breakfast and he's walking down the street and he walks through the park and people are doing yoga or playing Frisbee or whatever they're doing. And he's being uncharacteristically happy. And it was designed to be a song driven sequence, but it was always intended to be a song driven sequence driven by an original song by Pharrell. That's sort of was the architecting, the design of the musical landscape of the film. And it might seem crazy. A lot of trial and error from Pharrell to come up with the song that just, I mean, now in hindsight, of course, there's a guy being happy in the movie. So Pharrell wrote a song called Happy. Seems obvious in hindsight. Yeah. It wasn't so in the journey to get there.
Right.
But obviously it all worked out nicely. The difference being when you compare and contrast it to like a 50 Shades example, the song Happy as a standalone thing was not a hit until like 9 months, 6 months, 6 to 9 months after the movie came and went from theaters. So it was there. It was an enjoyable part of the initial experience of the film in a movie theater. It was a really cool song, but it didn't really catch on and take off in a huge way till after the movie came and went. And so there's a creative consideration or a bundle of creative considerations of how are we going to make the best movie and support it in the best way possible with songs and score and music. And then also the commercial considerations of, are we making songs that can help the marketing side of the film? Are we going to help open the film? If you talk about why make original songs, why make a soundtrack? You know, we can have a whole other conversation about the history of soundtracks and commercial soundtracks and music videos and why they exist and when was the heyday of soundtracks and what do they mean now versus what did they mean then? But I still think there's something valid to, you know, if you can hit that perfect target or series of targets, very small targets that all have to align in a certain way, you put the arrow right through the center of all those targets and you can have a song that works brilliantly in the picture, that's a meaningful part of the experience of the film, and it can be commercial and it can be a standalone song, it can be a hit, and it can be a hit before the movie opens, and you can get all those things to happen and line up. then that's the magic, that's what you're always chasing, right? Doesn't always work out that way, and you know, we can always strive to sort of aim that high and on everything that we do. And sometimes it works out, sometimes it doesn't, or sometimes you have a year like 2015 where it happens to work out a bunch of times and we all look like geniuses. But really, we're just trying to do the same thing over and over and over again for years and years and years.
Yeah. So, well, you know, a lot of what you're saying, I think the takeaway clearly, amongst other things, is just how creative you are with the way you think and how you approach both the creative and the business side of things, which that's a whole other topic, you know, is the creativity behind business, not just the creativity behind, you know, art or creative art, you know, these kinds of things. You've been very generous with your time. I have one last question for you.
Sure.
Do you have a favorite, either former or current, recording studio here in Los Angeles? You mentioned Todd I.O., which is one of my favorites, no longer around.
I'm partial to the scoring stage on the Fox lot, or I guess it's still the Fox lot, the former Fox lot. I mean, I'm very emotionally attached to that piece of real estate. I feel like I grew up there, working there for 14 years. And when I started working at Fox, the scoring stage was just undergoing the renovation to the configuration that it currently has, with the new control room and the old stage and the history of it. And when I started there in 96, they were just disassembling the pipe organ that was there for decades. And that's a whole other story, but that pipe organ disappeared for years and has now been lovingly restored and installed at Nate Barr's studio. And if you don't know about that, you should talk to Nate Barr and do a whole piece on the Fox pipe organ that he now has. It's sort of like a turn of the century Wurlitzer synthesizer that was used on tons of movie scores, but it was permanently installed on the Fox lot, you know, in the 1930s, I believe. But that studio, just the live room, which has been as untouched as possible over the years, and you have Marilyn Monroe singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, and Donald O'Connor and Ethel Merman singing No Business Like Show Business, and Julie Andrews singing Sound of Music, and, you know, dozens or hundreds of classic film scores by Jerry Goldsmith and Alfred Newman and Lionel Newman and David Raxon, and all the, you know, classics from the Fox catalog. And just to think that all of that magic happened in that one room, it's just a very special, very unique place, and hopefully it'll be there forever and ever and ever. There's just not that many of those places left. We have, you know, basically three left in LA, two frequently used facilities in London, and then a sprinkling of others around the world. But if I have one favorite studio, it would definitely be the Newman stage on the Fox lot.
It's an incredible stage. And so many, as you pointed out, amazing things have come through there over the decades. And you mentioned David Raxon. He was such a huge personality. I remember years ago when I was still in college, and he'd come into the room and try and, okay. That's how he always started a session on Theory or Harmony or whatever. But Well, look, I appreciate you being on the program very much. We're lucky
to
have you.
I'm a talker. I should have warned you. I talk a lot, but I feel like we burned through however much time that was, an hour and change, Justin. So thank you for having me. Sorry we couldn't get into more different things, but I feel like we covered a lot of ground. So hopefully that's helpful for you and at least some of what you were trying to talk about. And look, in the world that we're in right now, you know, stay safe and take care. And thanks for reaching out. It was fun to do this, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thank you, everybody. Mike Knobloch. We will see you next time on the next Film Music Focus. Until then.
Brought to you by Santa Concerts.